Okay, this time we begin the check net. I'm Dick, K2 Romeo India Whiskey. You'll also hear John, KC2 WGB. We have Paul, WS2N. And sometimes we also hear Hal, K6DPZ. That group of people tries to help organize this thing that we believe is educational. People sign in for the last 32 years, 1982 is when this all began. This is TechNet number 1523. So the curious people, the people who want to know a little bit more about radio and how it works, they gather here in a group of smart people. There's a lot of brain power in the New York City, New Jersey, Connecticut, Southern New York State, Long Island area. They gather and help each other find out how radio and transmission line and antennas and transmitters and receivers and propagation, how all this stuff works. The schools do only a mediocre job of teaching the subject. You want a real radio man, you got to hire a ham radio operator. A person signs into the TechNet by giving that group of people your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not sign in because you're listening. After 32 years, we believe somebody is listening. After 1,523 TechNets, we believe somebody is listening. Doesn't have to be proven to us anymore. We think it's a record that one particular net under one group of people has been run for 32 years and 1,500 times, and lately we average 4 hours from 8 o'clock until 12 o'clock, so there's about 5,000 hours worth of TechNets that have taken place. You can see many of those TechNets by going to the beautiful website of Mike, KC2NJI. For the last 6 or 7 years, all of them are recorded. You go to amateurradio.tangovictor and look up the right year, the right month, the right week, and in 1 hour wheels, you can play that back. There's another beautiful website by the other Mike, K1MJM, and that website is LimarkTechNet.com, in which quite a bit of other information of interest to Limark, to TechNet listeners, TechNet contributors takes place. So this time we're going to take check-ins. If you've got a question or a comment for the net, give me your call letters and name right now, K2RIW. Okay, we got nothing but listeners tonight, so we'll close down the net early, and I guess we'll go on to other things. What do you think, John? KC2WGB, K2LAW.
AA2GES.
Okay, GES. I think it was Kilo Alpha 2 Golf Echo Sierra. Please tell us your name, sir.
Yeah, Dick, it's KA2GEF, General Electric Fan, and the name here is Bob, and I have a question.
Okay, Golf Echo Foxtrot, if I got it right, and we got you, Bob. Anyone else to check in, give me your call letters and name right now.
Kilowatt Delta 2, Foxtrot Queen United Mobile.
And Foxtrot Queen United Mobile, please tell us your name, sir.
Thank you, Dick. The name's John, Juliet Oscar November, Juliet Oscar November.
Yeah, you've told us that 2 weeks in a row. I'm very forgetful, John, so forgive me. Once again, John, will you be within range for a while, or should we pick you up in a hurry to make sure you're still in range? Over to you, John.
I'll definitely be in range. Definitely be in range, and yes, I have a question.
Very fine. We got Bob and John. Anyone else to check into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now.
ED2BHY, Jim, and yes.
Okay, I heard blank 2BHY. What's the prefix there, Jim? Jim, BHY, what came before the number 2? Is it KD2BHY?
Yeah, that's correct. KD2BHY.
Very fine, Jim. You started talking before the machine picked you up, so the beginning wasn't there. We've got Bob, John, and Jim checking in so far. Anyone else checking with the TechNet with a question or a comment? Give me your call letters and name right now.
WS2N, Paul, with the Space Report. Good evening, John, Dick, everybody else.
Looking forward to that, Paul. And anyway, anybody, first call. Anyone else to check into the TechNet with a question or a comment, give me a call, letters, and name right now. We've got more than enough to get started, so let's go back to Bob. Kilo Alpha 2, Golf Echo Foxtrot. You've got it, Bob. KQRIW, my name is Dick.
Okay, good evening, Dick. I'm installing an antenna on a 20-foot mast. I have a 899 for my 10 meters. It's a fiberglass antenna, basically around 18, 17 feet long. And the other one is a coaxial antenna, which is for 6 meters. And then there's the third one, another coaxial antenna for VHF, 2 meters. Now, I'd like to install using a cross member made from Kindorf, the two longer antennas, and put the 2 meter coaxial on the middle. Let me drop it. And my question is, will there be any interaction between the 2 meter, 6 meter, and the VHF? And how long should the Kindorf, there's two pieces of Kindorf, and it's spread about 18 inches apart. This way I can have a good bite on both masses.
Because all of those antennas are tuned to different frequencies, and as you may have heard me say so many times before, Bob, to make an antenna work well as a transmitting antenna, as a radiating antenna, or as a receiving antenna, you resonate it first on the desired frequency, then it can radiate. If the radiating system doesn't resonate on your frequency, its ability to radiate is drastically decreased. That being said, those three antennas, if you wanted, could all be mounted at essentially the same altitude with only a couple of feet of separation between them. You'd be amazed how close you could be. And except for the fact that the higher frequency antennas will see a little bit of capacitive loading. The tips of the higher frequency antenna will see a little bit of capacitive loading from the lower frequency antennas that are nearby. So if you were smart enough to mount the 2 meter antenna so that the tip of it is slightly above the others, the 6 meter antenna so the tip of it is slightly above the 10 meter antenna, if you did that, you could have an extremely short distance between them and essentially no interaction on transmitting. Let me drop this slight catch. If this is the best of all worlds, you'd like to be able to transmit on any one band and simultaneously listen on the other three with no desensitization of that receiver that's doing the receiving. That's the one place where you would run into a bit of a problem, because the so-called power spread, in other words, the difference between the signal strength coming out of the transmitter and the signal strength going into a receiver is such a huge number. A good transmitter might put out, we'll say, 50 watts. That's plus, I think it's plus 57 dBm, if I get that right. Let me think now. Plus 20 would be 100 watts. No, that's plus 30 is a watt. Plus 40 is 10 watts. Plus 50 is 100 watts. So plus 47 dBm is 50 watts. A good receiver can receive like minus 120. So we're talking about 160 or 150 decibels of difference between transmit and receive. The bottom line of all that is that even if you put the transmitting antenna on the eastern end of the house and the receiving antenna on the western end of the house, separated by 50 feet, there's a chance that your receiver will be overloaded, desensitized, unless it had a pretty fancy filter in front of it, only passing that one particular band. So if you wanted simultaneous transmission reception, you might not be able to do that. However, the amount of coupling between the antennas from a transmitting point of view is going to be so small, you could separate them all by a couple of feet horizontally, have them all essentially at the same altitude, and they will work, and each antenna will look at the other antenna as a transparent object. Let me drop. When you're on 2 meters, the other two antennas are transparent objects. Your eye sees them as substantial things, radio-wise, because they don't resonate on that frequency. They're 95, 98% transparent, so to speak. I've also used Kindorf as a construction material on towers. And it's a very nice, convenient material because it's got holes in it all over the place and easy to mount U-bolts and whatever. That's the good news. Kindorf, though, unless you find some way of buying it as a very special product where it's hot-dip galvanized, it will acquire rust within a small number of years. So Kindorf, as an outdoor construction material, has that problem. Aluminum tubing, for instance, wouldn't have that problem, particularly if you're using galvanized U-bolts and saddles on the U-bolts that hold on to the aluminum tubing. So as long as you're willing to have some rust of the Kindorf within a few years, it's a very handy construction material. So maybe some of that helps a little bit, and maybe you got some further questions on this, Bob. Go ahead, John. KC2WGB has got a comment. You got it, John. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Kindorf is available in stainless steel. It's not that expensive, but he's going to be bolting this, I assume, with U-bolts onto PVC. He has to make sure he's got substantial walls on that PVC, maybe 2-inch or better, as far as diameters, to be able to support and maintain that without fracturing the PVC. But all of that is available in stainless steel. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, John. Eric? I for one, when it comes to 20 feet of mast, I didn't hear whether or not Bob is going to use that as PVC. I'm a big enthusiast of aluminum. You get a lot of strength to weight ratio and a lot of web of protection out of a 6061 T6 alloy of aluminum tubing. PVC as a construction material has its limitations, although there are ways you can beef it up with proper guying or whatever to give it the strength and stiffness you like. KE2EJ, K2RIW, how would you do this, Eric?
Alright, I wasn't sure if somebody was saying they're going to use PVC for a mask, but my recommendation is don't. This stuff snaps. And the stuff that you get from Home Depot or the places that are used for water won't really thick enough to. The drainage stuff is 3-inch or 4-inch, but I don't think anybody's going to use that for that. Anyway, when we put Kindorf on the tower, we do what John says, stainless, and if it's not available at the time that we're doing it, we paint it. That helps. K2RIW, K2EJ.
Okay, when you do paint the Kindorf, probably use gold, cold galvanized spray paint. Is that what you use, Eric? Go ahead.
No, we use the FAA color epoxy-based paint, which is literally sticks to anything, and I mean anything.
Okay, well, I got you here. There's an installation I'm going to be involved in where the tower is going to be painted brown so it doesn't become overly obvious to where it's going to be placed. And the tower itself will start off as a brand-new hot-dip galvanized zinc. So, to your knowledge, does the commercial brands of paint you're talking about, do they require a special primer coat in order to make a good bond to the zinc? Does the zinc require pickling, pre-preparation, or can this epoxy-based paint, chosen of the right color, just be put directly on top of the zinc and do the job? What's your feeling on that one, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Well, I'll be very honest with you. My experience has shown me what galvanized is in hot-dip galvanizing isn't done right. If the galvanizing is done properly, the stuff lasts 30 years easily. No problem adhering to the zinc. But the galvanizing has to be done properly, and I've seen some stuff where it just wasn't done right, and it just pulled right off.
A2GEF.
Yeah,
John.
GEF and John in that order. Well, since the galvanizing I'm going to be purchasing is done by Roan, even though Roan has been repossessed a number of times, I'd like to believe that they've still not lost the recipe as to how they do hot dip galvanizing. So we're going to go to Bob and John in that order. K-A-2-G-E-F, K-2-R-I-W. Go ahead, Bob.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, no, I'm not using PVC at all. Never think of it. I'm using galvanized pipe. And there's 2.5 inch. I believe it's 2.5 inch. And they are clamped with a galvanized clamp that I had from an old antenna. That's it. Okay, no, I thank you. That did help. And as long as I can get them all up and down, I'll let you know how it works out. Thank you, K-A-2-G-E-F.
Sounds good, Bob. And as you do install this and get a chance to try it out, please come back and let us know the good news or the bad news, what worked and what didn't work, and what modifications you made as you actually went and did it. Not quite sure how we got led down the garden path to think you're using PVC. Glad to hear you're not. There are people who have used PVC for booms and for very short yagis with a couple of elements, and that can work pretty well. Long yagis, I'm not an enthusiast of PVC. I'm a big aluminum fan. KC2WGB with some further comments. K2RAW, go ahead, John.
Say PVC. Okay, that guy could be wrong. I also want to just let them know that they do make Kendorf in PVC coated. You can buy that along with all the U-bolts, brackets, and shoes, all PVC coated if you want to go that way. It's a little cheaper than stainless steel, but if you're going to do that, you might as well go for stainless. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Why are you painting the tower brown?
Who said I'm painting the tower brown? The particular installation, it's a recommendation. Next time you and I are having an eyeball or a landline, I'll give you some more of the details of that particular installation, John. Here we go, Eric. And so, yes, I know it's unusual, but there's a good reason to do that. The particular installation is such that a shiny new tower put in that particular place, there's a slim chance somebody might say, gee, I object to that. Whereas something that's an unobtrusive color and not shiny and bright, if you know what I mean, is nowhere.
There's no aircraft lights.
Okay, it's not going to be exceeding 200 feet, so no aircraft lights are required. No FAA requirements for the red and white paint. When you exceed 200 feet above the ground, the FCC has got requirements and the FAA has got requirements where you have to be listed on the aeronautical charts, and there's a well-documented method of painting the red and white stripes of a very specific colors that are required. Back to you. Any further comments on this one, Eric? K2EJ, K2LAW.
KTC.
No, I was just asking if that it was 199 feet less or so. If it's 200 feet or more, brown is a no-no. Okay.
TCTC is comment.
Yeah, Hal recognized. No, we're not talking about 190 feet of tower. And I know the one you're talking about, Eric. K60PZ, who probably has painted a number of towers in his time. K2RIW, you got it, Hal.
Yeah, they basically, one-seventh of the tower, each seventh has to be either red or white. Red has to be starting at the tip. That's my only comment.
Yeah, that is the requirement if you're within a certain distance of an airport or if you're exceeding 200 feet above the ground. Then the FAA requirements and the FCC requirements and the listing for the aeronautical charts, the sectional charts, the structure has to be listed as a potential hazard to air navigation. As long as it's below 200 feet, I believe those FCC and FAA requirements are no longer take place. Back to you, Hal, for a confirmation on that. K16BZ, K2RIW.
You know, they gave that job to Rockwell Collins.
I remember, Dick, for the FARs, that's how it's been. It hasn't been changed. Over 200, you have to follow the 1/7 rule.
Unless it's 1,000 feet or 2,000 feet, and then there are multiple stripes of X number of feet tall, and you could have more than 7 stripes total. I've seen some of those on the really tall structures. Now, you just said something, Eric. You said it very briefly, and I didn't quite get the message. I heard the words, but I didn't get the message. K KE3J, K2LIW.
Yeah, what I said was the FAA gave tower legislation and no can distribution to Rockwell Collins. They don't do it themselves anymore.
Okay. If the FAA gave that to Collins, in other words, I think you're telling me you now make your application to Collins when it comes to a new tower installation that's more than 200 feet above the ground? Is that what you're saying?
No, you still go through the front office. You still go through the FAA. But, for example, when I have a light out, you think you're calling the FAA, but you're not. You're calling Rockwell Collins, the company, I think they're in Colorado or something. They manage the administration of all that stuff.
Okay, that's good to know. Thank you. Next person on the list was John. Kilo Delta 2, Foxtrot, Quebec United, Mobile. What would you like to talk about tonight, John? K2LIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, K2RIW. This is KD2FQU, and good evening, everybody. Two questions. First question is antenna tuner for a random wire. I've seen the Elecraft KX3 used with its antenna tuner built in, and a standing wave SWR of 20 or less to 1. Works great for a random wire, but my mobile rig is a 857D Yaesu, and the one that I've read up on from Yaesu only does 3 to 1, and YT100 from, I think, LGD Technologies does about the same. Any comments or assistance with a good antenna tuner that's compatible with the Yaesu FT857D.
KXDT's regular comment.
You got it, Hal.
I suggest using an ICOM 84, which is a very good tuner, and you could use it with the 857. The ICOM tuner also has an auto start on it, and it's random wire feed, so it has a very broad impedance characteristic, and you could almost match a bed spring with it. I know I've had very good luck with the AH4 versus some of the other, you know, auto tuners I've used.
Well, there's another thing going on here that's not quite obvious, John, and that is when the manufacturer tells you it'll match any standing wave ratio of less than 2 to 1 or less than 3 to 1, they're talking about all possible phase angles. If you take any of the brand names of antenna tuner, and if you filled in the Smith chart, colored in the Smith chart in the areas where it can handle the standing wave ratio, you may find out that the worst case situation is 3 to 1, but in some particular corner of the Smith chart, the that particular 3 to 1 rated antenna tuner may easily tolerate a 20 to 1 of a particular phase angle. The bottom line of that is that once you've established your antenna, and you know what its impedance is, and maybe it's got a high standing wave ratio you can't correct, if you have the right length of transmission line between the antenna and the antenna tuner, what that extra transmission line is doing is it's walking around the perimeter of the Smith chart. It'll walk you into the phase angle where your antenna tuner can handle a higher standing wave ratio. I didn't say it's easy to find that magic spot, but on most antenna tuners, there's a magic length of transmission line where it'll match a huge standing wave ratio of a particular phase angle. So choosing the right brand name, choosing the right way of using it, is going to do great things for you. Also, don't let all of those guys on 20 meters, let me drop. Don't let all those guys on 20 meters, many of them have an extremely strong opinion that all of the reflected power from the antenna due to standing wave ratio that comes back to the antenna tuner gets wasted. You'll be amazed how many people believe that hogwash. A well-designed antenna tuner, when it's being used, runs ice cold, dissipates no power, it's well shielded, it radiates no power. What it's doing with all that reflected power is re-reflecting it forward. You probably tune things. It's re-reflecting it forward in phase with the power coming out of the transmitter right now. And so as long as the feed line is low enough in loss, all of that power still gets radiated. An antenna tuner is essentially lossless. it's got rather small amount of loss, if it's a well-designed one being used properly. So don't let them talk you into that, what I called old wives' tale on that one, John. KD2FQU, I think that was your first question. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, I have another comment, K6DP.
You got it, Hal.
Now, we don't know if he's just running a random wire or feeding us a, antenna system with coax or what he's doing on mobile configuration. He didn't say enough information what he's doing, as far as what type of antenna he's trying to match.
Okay, I gave him general information for almost any kind of antenna. And the most severe antenna I know of is a so-called NFED ZEP, a random length of wire. ZEP really means Zeppelin. In the days when they used to trail a wire out of the back end of a airship, a lighter than airship, a Zeppelin, a blimp, you could always force that wire into resonance with the right kind of an antenna tuner. And if you're smart enough to choose the right length of antenna so that you're choosing, you're feeding the end of a dipole, so to speak, not the center, so that the high impedance point is coming back to the point of feeding at the Zeppelin, then with a broad enough range of the antenna tuner, that becomes an extremely efficient antenna. Lots and lots of people think an antenna does not work well without a local ground. Well, when you're 10,000 feet in the air in a blimp, there is no local ground. And if you're feeding things correctly, the blimp itself is a beautiful ground as far as the rest of the universe is concerned. So tell us what kind of antenna it is, John. Quite possibly, Hal's got some further suggestions for you. KD2, Foxtrot, Quebec United, Mobile, K2RIW.
Thank you very much, Dick and Hal. It's just random wire. I haven't gone into the specifics yet. I was just investigating. I was able to resonate off of an SWR analyzer, a simple dipole from a coax connection I had. I left the quarter wave, 2 meter setup, and it was great. I was able to get a very good SWR, a 1-to-1 match, and a 1.1 match at a 145 I centered it at. But that's from the braid from the coax I used. And the wire I'm still working on is a copper 10 gauge. I'm still trying to figure out how to attach the feed line too. And my second part to the question would be, what would be a good application for attaching aluminum braid to tin or just copper wire for the other end of the feed line?
I heard the word aluminum braid, and I'm having trouble understanding what it is, where it is, where is it being put. Are these ground plane radios being made out of aluminum? You said the word aluminum braid is what it sounded like. There was a couple of dropouts there, so give us a few more words on what you're trying to do. I know that there are dissimilar metal problems whenever you bring aluminum and copper together, for instance, and you got to be careful if you want to make good electrical contact, particularly out in the weather for any length of time. So give us a little further description as to what's going on at that interface. You got it, John.
Okay, well, I should be in a better area here for our reception to the repeater. I'm using RG6, and I haven't placed a SO239 or even a PL259 connection at the other end. This is just for anchoring onto a copper. I was able to twist and make the copper 10-gauge wire, which is about 10 feet in length. I was able to bond it. To each portion of the twisted, I was able to bond the sensor conductor to that copper 10 gauge wire, cut 10 feet in length, just the aluminum braid from the RG6 as the other side of that dipole. I know it's difficult to solder aluminum to copper, so I was figuring maybe I can clamp something down or have it attached to something where I can have it on that dipole. I'm just trying to figure out what it could be in order to apply that to that dipole.
Okay, you see seem to have the feeling that RG6 cable has an aluminum braid. It may be a tin braid, it may be a braid that's above or below an aluminum sheet, a foil. When you buy the right kind of a connector intended for the RG6, the connector itself will have the proper materials that properly bonds the braid, the foil, and whatever. So installing the right kind of connector on the end of the RG6, I think, is the beginning of the process of making good contact to the rest of the antenna system. Let's see what Hal's going to say about this one. K6DBZ, K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, maybe Hal's not available. John, have you ever installed connectors on RG6? I think Radio Shack, among other places, has a connector intended for installation on RG6. I also believe that the braid on RG6 is tinned copper. It may have an aluminum foil. I don't think there's any brand of coaxial cable that we normally buy where the outer braid is aluminum. I may be wrong on that one. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet. You've been buying quite a bit of cable lately.
Not wrong, Dick.
KC2WGB. Eric Rick again. Dick, they do make RG6U with an aluminum braid. I've seen that. I don't think it's easily available. Most of them are, just like you said, tin copper. And if you buy the correct connector, it looks much like the RG59, but it has a longer barrel, and it's made for RG6. And even for quad shield, it will fit. If you crimp that down, that will make an excellent connection.
Sounds good, John. Eric, have you ever heard of aluminum braid on RG6? That's a new one on me. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2J. Well, I've never seen aluminum braid on RG6. Stuff looks like aluminum, but it's not. It's just deflated copper. And the difference between the RG6 and the RG59 connector, not so much a longer barrel, John. The diameter, the inside diameter of an RG6 connector is a little bit bigger than an RG59 connector. We're talking F connectors here. And if you're going to use F connectors, that's bad. Good luck to you in a couple of years. They work. They make good contact at first. And if you shield them from the environment, they'll last a long time. And if you're working with 72L, that's all. K2RIW, K2J.
Yeah, you brought up a good point. RG6 is a 75-ohm cable. Therefore, most people will use it with F connectors. There is a 75-ohm BNC connector, but it's rare. And to try to find the combination of an RG6-rated connector with a BNC on one end of it, that's a bit rare. Excuse me. And what Eric is talking about is the raw F connector is itself not a weatherproof connector. But if you're smart enough to pile coax seal, duct seal, and whatever around the connector and then wrap it with tape, you can make a good weatherproof connector an F connector. I've done it. And depending on which brand of cable you buy that has the F connectors already installed for an antenna, sometimes it comes with a rubber boot that does a very good job of weatherproofing an F connector. So putting an F connector or any other kind of rated connector on the end of the cable, I think, is a good way of going. To take the braid and just simply twist it to something else is a little bit less reliable a connection, in my opinion. Although I guess with the right kind of a twist nut, it could be done pretty well. KD2, FQU, as you finally settle this one, come back and let us know what you did, John. K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, John.
Thanks very much, Dick. Well, I have the materials. I used to be an installation technician for Dish Network, so I have a Vextra cable. I have the cable that they use for WildBlue and the HughesNet installations for the internet, which is pure copper under conductor, and it's aluminum, or at least it looks like aluminum. A braid, a single braid. It's not the quad shield, it's a single dual shield.
and some other cables that I do have, probably copper-tipped aluminum semiconductor with what looks like braid that's aluminum or tinned copper. I was having a difficulty placing or trying to solder that braid onto the dipole I have, which is pure copper, 10 gauge.
Yeah, were you having trouble using the right kind of a rosin and hot enough iron and good solder, and the solder wouldn't take to the braid? It does suggest that the braid is something that's not easy to solder to, in which case putting a connector on the end of the connector, on the end of the cable, and then using that connector as a method of making contact to the rest of the system, I think is the right way to go. And hopefully the connector is made out of, if you choose the right connector, it's made out of compatible materials that will mate with that RG6 cable. So let us know how that turns out, Jim. Next person on our list was, in fact, John, I'm sure it's said. Jim is the next guy on our list. Kilo Delta 2, Baker Hotel Yankee. You've got it, Jim. K2RIW in the Tech Net.
Yeah, thank you, Dick. I just had a question about a dipole that I had set up. I was having trouble getting on it.
Jim, we heard you say that you were about to install a dipole. You were having trouble as a... and then you had a sudden dropout. Maybe a dead battery, maybe the rig hopped to another frequency. We'll stand by until you come back with the rest of the question. Kilo Delta 2, Baker Hotel Yankee. K2RIW, you got it, Jim.
I'm sorry, I think the radio's out of battery. I'll ask it.
Further comment on the last one.
Okay, give us a comment on the last one.
I use RG6 BNC connectors. They do crimp, and whether it's in fact is aluminum or in place copper, maybe after a zillion years electrolysis will occur, okay, but BNC connectors are not that unusual. Actually, you can buy them from the dealer, and thousands or any of those places. They're order the right price, that's all.
A real 75 ohm BNC connector has a semiconductor that's quite small in diameter, easy to damage, easy to make poor contact, particularly if you make the mistake of mating it with a 50 ohm connector, a 75 ohm male connector interfacing a BNC type, for instance, or type N interfacing with a female.
The diameters of the pins are different, but I'm assuming it's going to use all 75 ohm connectors.
Yeah, you got to make sure that it's all the same. Because the connector is so small in length, even if the connector is a 50 ohm connector and you've got a 75 ohm cable, because the connector is so short in length, it's an extremely minor perturbation to a system, unless you're on 2 gigs and above, so to speak. So I'd be very tempted to use a 50 ohm connector if they made one that would mate correctly with the RG6 cable, as opposed to choosing a 75 ohm, because interfacing 75 ohm connectors for us normal people is a problem. In your world, where all of your video cables are 75 ohms or 90 ohms, it's probably quite a bit easier. Is that true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2LIW, KE2EJ. Actually, I've never seen connectors made specifically for RG6, but I've never seen a connector with a 50 ohm pin. Now, the stuff that we use is 75 ohms in the video world. And 90 ohms, by the way, we use for control signals for like character generators and stuff like that. But that's like way old technology these days. I mean, we don't even stick video through coax anymore. It's all freaking Cat 5, believe it or not. Actually, Cat 6.
Yeah, Cat 6 is a beautiful cable. You could use a little bit more audio, by the way. Cat 6 is a beautiful cable. I ran an experiment with Cat 6 where I was using it at 915 megahertz. I remember measuring rather small amounts of insertion loss at 915 megs RF. I'm not quite sure what what data rate it's rated for. Do you know what data rate RG6 is rated for, Eric? And by the way, that data rate you're about to give me, is that for all four twisted pairs being used simultaneously? One particular twisted pair, what do you believe is its maximum data rate or frequency response? As I said, I found it rather good at 915 megahertz. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
KE2RIW, KE2EJ. Actually, you could exceed 10 gigs in terms of data rate and Cat6 that's using all four pairs. But actually, Intel makes a set of drivers that are bidirectional. It uses two lines in one direction, two lines in the other direction. And you can actually stick a little bit over a gig worth of analog bandwidth through it and comes out the other end. Really cool.
Yeah, both Cat5 cable and Cat6 cable contains eight individual wires with eight individual colors, four twisted pairs, and as you study those wires, you realize that it's an extremely exotic, very inexpensive design where the twist rate on the four twisted pairs have four different twist rates. As such, they are very well isolated from each other, even though they're all wrapped together in the same insulated outer covering. In the case of RG6 cable, there's a plastic holder in there which holds the four twisted pairs in a particular configuration so that they really are low on crosstalk, very well-designed cable, even though it's made out of relatively inexpensive materials. I wonder if Jim was able to find another battery or recharge his battery or whatever. KD2, Baker Hotel Yankee, if you're still there, Jim. K2LIW in the TechNet. Yeah, that's very disappointing when Murphy's Law dictates that just when it comes up to you, that's when the battery on your handy talkie goes dead. That's what I think Jim ran into. So he was going to feed a dipole, and I'm going to give you guys a couple of words on dipoles. There's a 10% chance I'll hit his problem. In the case of a dipole, everybody believes you've got to have the dipole flat out, parallel to the ground, fed in the center, hopefully with a balancing device and the coax cable in the center. That's the traditional way of doing it. There's nothing magic about feeding the dipole in the center. The dipole is an energy storage device like a flywheel. The energy that your transmission line puts into the dipole, that energy is going to bounce back and forth 10 or 20 times before it finally gets radiated. I keep saying the antenna has to be resonated first before it can radiate, and the reason for that is radiation is hard. It doesn't happen easily. You'd like to believe the energy goes into the dipole and just jumps into space. It doesn't do that. 5% of the energy gets radiated on each pass, and it's got to bounce back and forth a whole lot of times before it finally gets radiated. Therefore, you want all those bounces to be co-phased, to be in step with each other. That's what resonance means. And when you get them in step with each other, the current builds up to a higher current. That makes a stronger magnetic field. The stronger magnetic field helps the radiation. You don't have to feed the dipole in the center. You can feed it 10%, 50%, 100% off of center, all the way out to the outer edge if you want to. Let me drop. An extremely convenient antenna for either temporary or permanent installations, like a field day installation, would be to use a slingshot or a bow and arrow to launch a piece of wire up to a tree, up high into a tree, and the one single piece of wire with no center insulator, make that piece of wire nearly half wavelength long, and the outer edge of the wire down at the bottom, this is a vertical piece of wire, you feed it with an impedance step-up device. When you feed the outer tip of a dipole, you're not feeding 70 ohms, you're feeding 2,000 ohms roughly. So if you've got the right kind of an impedance step-up device, which could be a wide-range antenna tuner, you're feeding 2,000 ohms, and under those conditions, you're feeding such a high impedance, you don't need 32 ground plane radials. One simple stake in the ground is more than enough ground plane counterpoise for that antenna when you feed that high impedance at one end. Very convenient antenna. It'll have 100% efficiency and work extremely well. And it's a simple installation. You'd be amazed how many guys who have made, say, for instance, a 20-meter half-wave dipole out of helical wound things, like those those helical wound stick antennas that used to be popular on 11 meters when they dropped. And there was a guy in the past who told us about taking a pair of those back to back that resonated on 20 meters. And he set this up vertically and used as the counterpoise nothing but the metal railing, the guard railing on the balcony of his apartment. And that worked on 20 meters extremely well. No real ground plane radials or whatever fed the outer tip of the thing. So there's lots of ways of feeding a dipole. Just because all the diagrams in the book show you the dipole horizontal, parallel to the ground, fed in the center. Just because that's the traditional way. You don't have to do it that way. You get a lot of advantage of doing it the other way, if you know what I mean. Even though people haven't popularly done it, haven't told each other about doing it. And so try it, you'll like it. Anybody have any further comments on all of the above, give me a call, let us right now. K2LIW in the TechNet.
I got a question for you.
Okay, he's got a question for you. Go right ahead.
Let's say in the case of a 40-meter dipole, by the way, K2LIW, K2J. In the case of a 40-meter dipole, you've got a really good dipole that works real well, it's 7.2 megs. How would one go about, and I have my answer, how would I go about increasing the bandwidth of the antenna while still trying to maintain the SWR down as low as I can across that bandwidth? How would you approach that, Dick?
KGPC with a comment. You got it, Hal.
Biggest diameter conductors you can for the dipole. That will give you a broader bandwidth. Go ahead, Eric.
If you read the Chapter 4 of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, and you look at the so-called Brown and Woodward curves, at 67 feet long for a half-wave dipole and 7 megs, 40 meters, to make it a large enough diameter in wavelengths, to really get substantial bandwidth out of it, you'd like to make it a foot or two in diameter. You're not likely to do that. You could, in theory, have a 67-foot long piece of copper tubing, aluminum tubing, that's the right diameter, but that's not likely. The Brown and Woodward curves will show you on curve number 3 or 4, I think it is, the so-called double conical. In other words, if you make a skeleton conical antenna, the double conical antenna as a television receiving aerial in the late 50s, early 60s was very popular. It's built out of wire. So it's a diamond-shaped layout of wire as a dipole. And so even though the rest of the material is not there to fill it out as a round object, as a cone-shaped object, you can fool the RF. So a broad-range antenna tuner, double conical-like layout of the wire is going to give you a lot of bandwidth, as I see it. And so you know what you got to do to lay out a cubical quad antenna. You only have to do it on the end, so to speak, when you're making this double conical-shaped thing out of wire. Let's see what you did, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is GTC with another comment. You're thinking, Dick, of the old Wonder Bar on 10 meters.
Okay, it has a name, Wonder Bar. Let's see what Eric did do. You got it, Eric.
Oh, I kind of cheated. I can understand how, conical, double conical antenna was at any few points that the distance is going to be a point of resonance. But I cheated. I added some capacitors to it, made the antenna a bit longer, and I started out at where I wanted to go, and basically jackbanged by trimming back, and of course the Q keeps getting lower the more you do it, but it kind of works.
Or else use a folded dipole, that would be a broader bandwidth.
Now, if I understood correctly, Eric, I think you did is you distributed capacitors along the length of the dipole. How many picofarads, how many capacitors, how did you distribute them? Give us a little more words as to how you did this, and did you get a chance to measure the bandwidth before you did this and the bandwidth after you did this? What kind of What kind of results do you believe you got? Give us some words on this one, Eric. K2RIW, over to KE2EJ.
Good morning, this is K2EJ. Well, the goal was to get between 7.2 to 7.25 to 7.175 without really having to retune anything. The retuning capacity is going to fall down. I tried it a number of different ways to equally space, and eventually I got to the point that I started to build the eggs by putting another string of wire behind it, but that's the whole other story. One thing led to another. So, the actual values of the caps were something like 100 puffs or 120 puffs. It's kind of high, but those frequencies, it's not really high. So, it was enough to be able to stay less than 2 to 1. Across that bandwidth, and actually I think it was like 1.8 or 1.7, something like that. But that led me to try something else, so, you know, one thing leads to another.
Can you hear the comment?
Yeah, first tell me, if you had built an ordinary wire dipole, it would have been 67 feet long. When you added some number of 100 or 120 picofarad capacitors, how many did you add? Roughly where were they located? Was the physical length of the antenna when you finished doing that still 67 feet? Over to you, Eric.
Now, I think the physical length of the antenna wound up being a bit longer. It wound up being like 16. And the capacitors were one across the center, and then I think I had two in the middle on each side. But it started out as just a straight old dipole, if I want to be. I had read something. I remember where I was reading it, so I figured I'd try it. So, played with that a little bit, and then went to essentially a directional long wire antenna.
CTC with a comment.
Yeah, how recognized. Were these transmitting rated capacitors? You could have synthesized those capacitors as a stub length of coax cable, and when you start confining stub lengths of coax cable, as you sweep in frequency, the length of the cable is electronically changing in wavelengths, and if you do things just right, you can get greater bandwidth out of that. So were these transmitting rated capacitors? Eric, go ahead.
So if I remember correctly, I think they were like 1,000 volts ceramic.
Yeah, there's ways you could have synthesized those capacitors out of lengths of cable that would drastically increase your bandwidth. I didn't say it's easy. Let's see, I bet you Hal's done some experiments like this. K6DBZ, K2RIW, what's the broadest dipole you've ever built, Hal?
RIW, K6DBZ. I've experimented with folded dipoles, where I've used 450-ohm ladder line, made a dipole, used a 4-to-1 ballon, and then came down and had very good bandwidth on 40 meters and also 75 meters. Tempered dipoles, of course.
Okay. Tell me about the standing wave ratio you had across 80 meters. What percentage of 80 meters did that structure you're describing cover with what level of ISWR?
Just trying to remember. 3.8 to about 3.9. I maintain less than 2 to 1.
Okay. If I built an ordinary 14-gauge household wire, 80-meter dipole, mounted 65 feet in the air, and I tuned it for 3850. What's your guess as to how high the standing wave ratio would be at 3.8 and 3.9? Over to you, Hal.
I would venture to guess that, because this was done a long time ago. I know it exceeded, the bandwidth characteristics exceeded using just a dipole. I was very happy with the results, both on an 80-meter dipole and a 40-meter. But being with a folded dipole, the impedance was four times higher. So I had a ballonet to my ratio down to a feed line.
Now, one of the patents I worked on, Mr. Dipole was on 915 megahertz, but still we managed to, using wide pieces of copper and a slightly exotic layout, we managed to make an antenna at 915 megacycles that was 150 megahertz wide, but our definition of bandwidth is where it did not exceed 1.05:1 standing wave ratio, 30 decibel reflection coefficient across 150 megahertz centered at 915. That's a 16.4% bandwidth antenna with a 1.05 Dusoir maximum across that 16% bandwidth. Obviously an extremely unusual dipole. And what that consisted of is a dipole and a loop combined, because, let me drop.
I just want a piece of substrate, by the way.
Yes, it was. It was laid out on a piece of clear plastic, and it was made out of copper tape. But a dipole, the simplest equivalent circuit for a dipole is a series LCR. And the series LCR, as you go up in frequency, the inductance goes up, the capacitive reactance goes down, so the antenna becomes inductive as you go up in frequency. An ordinary dipole becomes inductive as you go up in frequency. A loop antenna, by comparison, a half-wavelength diameter loop, half-wavelength circumference loop, the equivalent circuit for it is an LCR in parallel. A loop antenna, as you go up in frequency, it becomes capacitive in reactance. So if you combine a loop with a dipole, where one has increasing frequency where it becomes capacitive, and the other one increasing frequency becomes inductive, and if you tune them just right, you can make the rate of change of capacitor reactance and the rate of change of inductor reactance track each other. And if you've got just the right spacing between the loop and the dipole, and just the right shape and just the right width, the coupling between the two will change the resistive component in such a way. And when you get everything set up just right, you could never do this on a computer modeling program. Let me drop. This is all done in front of a vector network analyzer, where you're laying down pieces of copper, and you're holding tuning tools near it, and the vector network analyzer is automatically sweeping in frequency 30 times per second and displaying the standing wave ratio or the S11 on the screen. So as you're playing with these gimmick devices, you get an immediate answer in a fraction of a second as to whether or not you're going in the right direction. And when you get everything set up just right, you can make an antenna, as I said, 1.05 standing wave ratio, 150 megs broad, 16% bandwidth, 16.4% bandwidth, with an extremely low Dusoir. And when you look at that on the Smith chart, it has what we call the stalled impedance phenomena. The dot goes to the center of the Smith chart and stays there for 150 megahertz and doesn't move. The dot doesn't even wiggle. It doesn't even circle the center. You expand the Smith chart and it's still a dot in the center. The impedance just goes there and stalls. That's why we call it the stalled impedance phenomena. It violates the living daylights out of all of the respected formulas. The so-called Bode-Fano equation tells you what's the maximum bandwidth you can get out of an antenna by adding tuning arrangements to it, tuning LCR networks. Let me drop. The trouble with the Bode-Fano equation, which is extremely well respected for the last 40 years, is it's based on the assumption that the equivalent inductors and capacitors of your network are fixed in value as a function of frequency. The real world doesn't do that. In the real world, your equivalent capacitance, your equivalent inductance, is changing in its magnitude of capacitance and inductance. Now I'm not talking about reactance. I'm talking about its real value in picofarads and real value in nanohenries. Depending on how you lay out your equivalent capacitor inductor, the value is changing as a function of frequency. The formulas don't respect that. You also have something called the two-wheeler criteria as to what's the maximum bandwidth you can get out of an antenna of a particular volume. This antenna exceeds those formulas. So once we succeeded in building this antenna, filing the patent, and it became a product, we tried modeling it. The currently available modeling programs couldn't properly model something that wide. The number of finite elements became so large that it couldn't properly handle it. So therefore, this is an antenna you cannot model. You'll not find it by modeling, but by tweaking, you can easily find it if you know what you're looking for. And and is not violating the laws of physics, even though it is violating all of the very well-respected formulas for what's the maximum bandwidth you can get out of a dipole-like antenna. And we only needed, in our particular application, we only needed 30 megs of bandwidth. The fact that we got 150 megs of bandwidth